Mr. Joginder Singh, Rio Tree.
Government had made preparations and trenches and shelters had been dug. So when a raid took place, people would rush into these shelters. Well, the shelter would have been maybe holes dug into a ground and the top would have been covered with logs or timber being placed and a large amount of earth placed over it. And in fact, there's hardly anybody who would risk remaining outside during the course of a raid. Even those people who were told if there was nothing else, they would go under a table. Even government buildings and commercial houses, they had special rooms allotted for this purpose.
What about the MVC? Did they have to build any air raid shelters or dig any trenches while they were in St. Patrick's School?
No, we had to just make preparations ourselves, yes.
How did all of you do it?
It was just a case of making open trenches.
While you were at St. Patrick's School, did you have a chance to meet with other people, like the other volunteers from Singapore?
No.
At that time, how much confidence did all of you have in the defense of Singapore?
As far as confidence is concerned, I am prepared to say here and now that up to the 14th of February, one day before the surrender, we still thought the tide of battle would change in our favor.
When all of you shifted to Kampong Batak, were there any other people there together with the Malacca Volunteer Corps?
No, just...
Just the Malacca Volunteer
Corps? Only Malacca Volunteer. They were old coolie lines and they had... we were making use of them. By the side close to us, there was a Malay Kampong, no doubt. And the further away, there was a bomb dump. But then we were on our own.
What, St. Patrick's School, was the school ever being bombed by the Japanese?
No.
Could you describe to us the conditions at Kampong Batak?
Pardon?
The conditions at Kampong Batak.
Let's see, Kampong Batak, we had barracks on raised steel poles, about 8 feet, 7 feet. The floor of the barracks about 7 feet above ground level. Downstairs, under the barracks, was where the companies had the various offices. And lower down, away from them, was a large open tank filled with water for bathing purposes. We had in one corner our cookhouse, of course.
How many of you were living there?
Well, all of the 4th Battalion.
Was the place ever bombed by the Japanese?
You just see. We had bombs dropping and we were not hit. On one occasion, about 4 o'clock or 4 or 5 o'clock, a bomb done and dropped on the other side of the road, but none of us was hit. A few days later, at night, another bomb dropped, still closer, and when this particular bomb dropped, well, the blast of the bomb which went over me made me feel as if I was sitting close to a bakery with the oven door open. It was as warm as that. The next morning, sometime at daytime, there was a strong gale, and a coconut tree came crashing down Only then when we realized that, when we went close to a tree to investigate why it had fallen, we realized that the bomb which had dropped the previous night, a splinter of it had gone right through the trunk of the tree, and the trunk remained upright until blown down by the wind the next morning.
Were there any casualties during that incident?
During this particular incident, there's no casualties whatsoever. But on another occasion, about midday, the families, the kampong was hit. A family had sat down to dinner, or to lunch. They got a direct hit. And we could see every evening two or three bodies being taken along the road to a cemetery which was some distance away from us, and the people had to pass us and on the way to the cemetery. They lost quite a number of people.
How frequent were the air raids since the first one on the 8th of December?
How frequent were the air raids?
Since the first one.
Earlier on they were just they would have been after about a few days apart. But then the tempo of them was such that you could expect it every morning, about 10 or so. And some or other, I do not want to say that the Japanese were considerate. It might be that the distance they had to come was such that the women had finished their marketing by the time the siren sounded. While in Kampong Bata, we could see one long line of them spread out coming towards us.
While you were at Kampong Bata, did you have a chance to move out of the area, or were you all still confined to the barracks?
No, we were confined there. We were just... Because when it was in emergency, war was already on, and nobody could leave camp. We had our sentry posted.
How did all of you feel about not being able to do anything, and yet the war was going on?
Well, I do not know anybody. I don't think anybody's minds were free to let their thoughts wander in any other direction.
So you just accepted the fact that you could not.
We were accepted, except there was only one chap. Where was he? One chap. He had, Mr. Maniam was his name. He had married a Japanese girl in Malacca. And he got news by telegram that his wife was interned. Hearing the news, the next when he came out, he sought an interview with the commanding officer and wanted to resign immediately and tender. He just went there, he said to him, "I'm just resigning, I'm returning the uniform." The commanding officer told him, "Now look here, you are in the army, you are embodied. You are under orders. I order you to remain where you are and not to act foolishly. What is your complaint? What is your difficulty? Let me know. I'm a commanding officer. I'll try to sort it out." Well, he just showed a telegram. The commanding officer says, "Well, I understand how you feel about it. You are on no occasion to do anything at all on your own. Remain where you are. You're not resigning." And unofficially, he told somebody to keep an eye on him so that he did not act rashly. In the meantime, he got in touch with his authorities, and a couple of days later, he got another telegram, wife released, and is quite feeling happy about it. In fact, later on we were told that the chief police officer of Malacca, himself personally went to the detention camp, released, sent her home with a hamper of provisions.
How was the morale of the people like when they were all confined to the Kampong Batak barracks?
We just see. Right, it all depends on where we were. As far as we, the signalers, were concerned, well, we had very little contact with outsiders or the army or the enemy. But some of our boys who had to do signal work with those who went out to lay the cables and what are the barbed wires or do sentry work, in the evening when they came back, they were quite sad about it when they came and say, oh, we were strapped, we were machine gun, we had to take shelter, or well, bombs dropped in our locality. And one of them said, I had a very narrow escape. When I went down on the ground, the tin hat on my head had come off, and I didn't have time to gather it. The beam from the top of the roof came crashing right and fell right on the top of the tin hat and flattened it to a, and reduced it to pancake. So those sort of things of that sort did come reach us, and then those who were not involved in it or who were nowhere near it also feel a bit sad about it. But then they could not do anything. We, being the army and being guarded, they couldn't even think of escaping or running out of the army. There's these things, like some people were running away, those things never occurred to us.
When the Japanese landed in Singapore, did you receive news of that?
Did I?
Receive news of the Japanese landing in Singapore?
You see, since we were in Kampong Batak, the newspapers were still being printed, were still well available, and those boys who came delivered them to those residents in Kampong Batak, they had to pass in our area, and we also did have access to newspapers. In addition to the radio, we knew what was happening. It was when the Japanese were at Kranji area actually landing. At that stage, we were moved out from this passive duties, as I call it, in Kampong Batak, to the actual front line, and came to this Adams Road area, Bukit Timah Adams Road area, and we were well in the thick of the fight.
Do you remember when was that?
That would be about maybe by the 10th or so of February.
How did all of you receive the orders to move out?
The previous night, we could see lorries being loaded, and those who were the machine gun section of the infantry, they had all that metal boxes containing this ammunition being loaded into the lorries. And the next morning, the truck started heading towards the front line.
So all of you move out as a group, the entire Malacca Volunteer Corps?
Well, the actual movement had started from the previous evening of some units, but we, the signalers, took place the next following morning. And it was about midday, after midday, maybe about 2 o'clock or so, when we actually reached the front. But in the meantime, while passing through this Thompson Road area, from Thompson Road entering Mount Pleasant going, well, we were constantly being harassed by these machines, by planes machine gunning us. With the result, our trucks would go under shelter of the trees and whatnot, and then when the planes had gone in different direction, then go out.
Were there any casualties during that journey?
Not that time.
In the morning when you were when you left the place, were you all told where you were heading and why?
Well, this, we were not told. Nobody would tell us. All that we know is, ball and go and get into the trucks. And then we knew, we saw that the trucks were going towards an area where the sound of machine gun fire was getting more louder and louder. And the worst point is, while we were going in that direction from this reservoir area, we could see cannon, 25 pounders, being pulled away, coming towards the town by bare-bodied Europeans while we are going into the fire.
How many of you went to that place?
As far as I know, I would not know that, but there were a few trucks in front and a few trucks behind us.
Besides the signalers, who else were in the trucks moving in the area?
You see, we had our own trucks, and the infantry ones, they had their own trucks. So, I think all of us were moved out, and that was an area where we had to go to.
Do you remember which specific location were you stationed at? I mean, when you reached there?
You see, we had what is known as an advance headquarters and then an actual battle line where it had to be. We had from Thompson Road we branch up to Mount Pleasant, and when we go from Mount Pleasant on towards the Bukit Timah side of Adams Road direction, Dunyan Road direction, there were big European government quarter bungalows. One of those bungalows happened to be our headquarters. And the slope of the ground where we have Dunyan Road area and Adams Road area, that is where the others were.
The others meaning who?
And our infantry boys.
So they were there first before you reached there?
Well, we were just almost simultaneously we were there. And when we could see the way the Japanese were operating, they would throw a smoke screen, and then on the top you'd have these aeroplanes. They would start with their rifle fire, machine gun fire, and advance a few paces or so towards our direction, held by machine gun fire, and then by then the smoke would have cleared, and then they would stop. And slowly, that's how these tower were creeping towards us. And as far as we are concerned, the signalers, a few of us found a shelter and we just went into it until things were a little calmer. Mm-hmm. Then in the evening, we were told to go to our rear headquarters, as on the hill. As far as I was concerned, I was given the job of laying a line, telephone line, from our headquarters to the battle headquarters, commanding officers or the battle headquarters. By the when I laid my cable, there's only one. Mine was the only solitary line. But by the time when we surrendered, I'd say about 2 or 3 days later, the whole place was crisscrossed by other lines.
So when did you reach the headquarters after you left Kampong Batak?
Pardon?
When did you reach the headquarters after you left Kampong Batak?
The same day, we left in the morning. By evening, we had set it up.
When you reached there, who did you first report to?
I won't know, you see. Because the whole thing there happened to be some officers there. And there would have been our own men as well as some strangers there.
How long did you stay there?
Weapon?
How long did you stay there?
Until we surrendered.
How bad was the fighting there?
You see, I should say that we were in an area where the fight had not yet reached. There was an occasion of when we could hear, not very far from us, the sounding of machine gun and this cannon going on. From midday, they started turning sort of bluff, exploding, as if firing away for hours at a stretch. And early next morning, stragglers from the army that started coming in our direction, torn uniforms, no rifles, holding just half a bayonet without any, and then we knew that these people had taken part in the fight and were coming. And then our officers' directions were, well, whatever they want, give them. Before that, we couldn't even afford to lose, in peacetime, we couldn't even afford to lose a bullet. And here, with my own hands, I had to give away hundreds of them.
Who were these people?
They were Europeans as well as Indian soldiers whose units had been, broken by enemy fire, and they were, all scattered in all directions. They were, retreating.
Did you see any Chinese?
Yeah, pardon?
Any Chinese?
It is true that a few, one or two persons were Chinese, had been brought in, but they happened to be just ordinary people, either living in that locality or people caught in that area, and were suspected of being something who had no business to be there and were there for questioning. That's about all.
How did all of you feel when you see these soldiers coming in with torn uniform and all that?
Well, some of us, we were more or less numb, I should say. Well, all of us say, well, if today is their turn, tomorrow it could be ours.
So how was the morale of the group like when you were all put in the front line?
You say morale, I should say, up to the last minute, we were thinking that we were waiting for somebody to come and save us. Towards the latter say, we did get rumors, a lot of aeroplanes are on their way to Singapore. The British are sending hurricanes and Spitfires. They are being assembled in a hurry while the ships are still afloat. And we will be relieved in no time. Right up to the last minute, that was how morale was kept up by propaganda.
Were there any casualties in the Malacca Volunteer Corps while you were there?
You see, casualties in our area, I didn't. But when our boys were doing the barbed wiring, there were casualties there. You see, since nobody would tell us, it's only by word of, so-and-so was wounded, so-and-so was injured, so-and-so died. That's how it was. We hearing in the evenings, but beyond that, we won't know anything. But we did not see any casualties.
Not at Adams Road?
I did not see any.
So when the British surrendered, did you all know about it?
On the morning of the 15th, about 8-7 o'clock in the morning, somebody said, "Hey, look at it." We could see a big observation balloon some distance away from us in the sky. And the man in the balloon, he was directing the infantry's fire. That was early in the morning. And of course, in addition to that, we had the Japanese planes going around, machine gunning every few minutes. A little later in the day, maybe daytime, along Bukitima Road, where military trucks were passing, somebody said, "Hey, look, those two cars are going this direction. We see a white piece of cloth there. What is it? Surrender, ah?" And then said, "Oh yes, yes, I also saw the vehicle there. I think, some talk is going on the way for surrendering." And then they would have remarked to our officer, they say, it could be. But as the temple later on, about 12 o'clock or so, started getting, I mean, the activities in the front started getting reduced, we thought something was up. And by evening, well, it was more or less confirmed that talk is going on. And then we had orders about 4 in the evening or 4, well, to pile on our arms. So all that we did was, whatever rifles we had, we started stacking them outside. Then we came to know that the cessation had taken place. Fighting was almost over.
The observation balloon, was it from the Japanese?
From the?
Japanese.
From the?
The observation balloon, was it from the Japanese?
Oh yes, you just see what has happened is, the Japanese, the men in the balloon, well, could see the whole field of battle, and they could give information or signals to their men where to direct the fire. The only thing I would say, had the fighting lasted another couple of hours, we would have been overrun. Because they were on the other side of the hill. We were on this side, they were on the other side.
That was the 15th February morning.
Yes.
Did the unit destroy the guns and ammunition that were...
The what?
Did the unit destroy the ammunition and the guns that you had?
No, you see, we couldn't do anything but as it is. We had earlier on received instructions, if, like our telephone, so when you're on duty, if you find that your post is going to be overrun, pull out the mechanism or armature from your telephone box, take it out, bang the butt of your rifle on it, and damage it. But then there's no way of course damaging our rifles or ammunition. It's too, ammunition, nobody would want to do anything to it. But all that, we had instructions now. Everything is over, we are instructed to pile your arms, or bring out your arms and put them outside. Stack them up. That's what we did.
Was that the only instruction?
My pardon?
Was that the only instruction?
At that time, yes, that was the only instruction. But then later on, the order of the day, I mean, our commanding officers the following day read out the British commandant's, well, message being read out to all who are under command. Well, informing them everything.